ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Annual reports might be an odd thing to get excited about. And yet, here I am. I have three leather-bound reports in front of me. The covers are a rich red with gold embossing. They smell the way that old books do. A bit musty and dusty, but full of history. They're a time capsule of Australia's fledgling years in quantum computing, from the late 90s onwards. They map every step Australia took to eventually become a leader in the industry.
Yeah, and a lot of that history doesn't exist anywhere else. It's something, again, that I'm extremely proud of.
According to the best of the best, there's a reason our plucky country has made it so far in this weird world of computing.
That highly collaborative nature of Australians is one of the biggest reasons why I think Australia can win the race in building a quantum computer here, because that is what you need to build something complex and difficult. And I think it's something where Australians excel.
It does take a Herculean effort to build a quantum computer.
When you're trying to build a quantum computer, essentially what you're trying to do is control nature at its smallest scales. It's an evolution of technology that allows humans to control the world at that level.
And it doesn't stop there. Controlling nature at its smallest is one thing. Doing it a million times over is another task entirely.
And when you get to those kinds of scale, the challenges become different.
If we can overcome those challenges, Australia will become the first home to a quantum behemoth, a computer that can model nature itself. Nobody has come anywhere close yet. So, what will it take to get there? And will Australia get there first? This is Dead and Alive, a series of science fiction for ABC Radio National. I'm Jacinta Bola, and to understand if quantum computers will change the world, I need to know how it controls nature at its most unstable. And I might be in the best place possible to find that out. Episode 3, The Plucky Country. Our relationship with computers started a long time ago. So to understand where we are now with quantum, it helps to take a few steps back to 1949, when Australia's first digital computer, CYRAC, was switched on.
We're going to feed the tape now into CYRAC, and I press the appropriate control buttons on the console.
CYRAC, or the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Automatic Computer, was one of the first of its kind in the world.
You can actually see it go into the memory, filling up the cells of the memory.
What strikes me most about CYRAC is how similar it is in a lot of ways to present-day quantum computers.
Results from that calculation into the Flexoriter, which is going to print out the results for us.
CYRAC is still in one piece. It's on display in an unassuming corner of the Science Works Museum in Melbourne.
So this is the console. Round the back here.
Can we get in?
I've come here to get some guidance from Peter Thorne.
And here is the hard drive.
A retired computer scientist who first met CYRAC when he was in high school.
I was pretty impressed. And I guess that meeting, which would have been in the late 1950s, changed my life. Basically, from then on, this was the place to be. It was the biggest, probably most exciting piece of electronics in Australia. And it was the beginning of the new age.
Peter went on to graduate and then study at the University of Melbourne. CYRAC was there at the brand new computation laboratory.
Later on, my girlfriend, who later my fiancée, later my wife, worked there, and I hung around, as it were, and in the end I got the weekend gig of being the weekend service engineer.
In the 1950s, this hulking mass of Csirac was the absolute cutting edge of technology.
It wouldn't fit in the average lounge room. It would hardly fit in the average garage. And full, absolutely full, of vacuum tubes.
If, like me, your memory is a little hazy, those are glass tubes that control the flow of electricity. When Csirac was powered on, the vacuum tubes got so hot that you could smell the whole thing cooking.
It was a smell of hot insulation material and a smell, I suppose, of the sort of heated dust that you could get.
This is where those similarities between Csirac and a quantum computer get almost spooky.
It used to get quite warm and it had a fan system to cool it.
Many quantum computers need to be kept cool. In some cases, colder than outer space.
There was noise from the fans, which were running along.
Like its quantum offspring, the massive Csirac is also noisy.
And also noise from the input-output devices, sometimes clashing away, printing, busy.
Noise is an issue with quantum computers too, although it's a different kind of noise. More on that later. Another comparison, both Csirac and quantum computers are fragile. They can really easily be knocked off course. In the quantum world, when this happens, it's called decoherence. For Csirac...
Occasionally it was so overloaded that somebody tried to make a cup of tea in the tea room. When they turned on the jug, the computer stopped. We had all those problems.
Importantly, people thought Csirac was capable of much more than it actually was. They knew it was powerful, but they didn't quite understand the computer's limits.
Like they wanted us to solve crossword puzzles and things with it. Or
could it solve crossword puzzles?
No. And my wife later said that we never turned anybody down. So somebody would phone and say, can you ask the computer the name of an African tree starting with Z? So she'd go off to the library and try and find it for them because she didn't want to disappoint them. But the computer wasn't going to do that.
Quantum computers can't solve your crossword puzzle either, so don't go ringing IBM for help. I can only imagine that in the 1950s, it was impossible to predict how far this newfangled computing technology would go. In the nearly 80 years since Csirac was built, we've gone from a double garage-sized computer to pocket-sized computers that power our entire lives.
The devices are getting smaller every year. And so how can you make things smaller meant that new technologies had to evolve.
One big evolution was trading in vacuum tubes for the much more practical transistor. Transistors are the electrical switches that become the ones and zeros that then become your photo dump on Instagram. There are billions of transistors in your phone that make that happen. They're so small, they can all fit onto one tiny computer chip. But how small can they get? Surely there has to be an endpoint.
As you go below what we call about 100 nanometers, you get to the point where quantum physics starts to influence how classical transistors work.
This is Professor Michelle Simmons, founder and CEO of Silicon Quantum Computing, former Australian of the Year, and most importantly, a quantum physicist.
The quantum world is more fragile. It's different, obviously.
I know, we keep banging on about this, but quantum physics is weird. Really small things don't behave how you'd expect. A transistor the size of a subatomic particle isn't going to act like a regular one or zero. So how do you get something that small to compute?
At the beginning, in the 70s and 80s, it was seen that that would be a problem, like a barrier to the continuation of computing, classical computing.
But then in the 90s, spurred on by the shock of Shor's algorithm and flush with new money, the thinking among researchers started to shift. What if the weird quantum properties of subatomic particles aren't a barrier? What if they're an opportunity?
People started realising, actually, this is a benefit. There's a new transformational kind of computing that's going to come along when you can start to do things with smaller physical states rather than the digital ones and zeros that we've been used to in the classical computing world.
It had only been a few years since the technology was developed that enabled us to even see atoms. Now, Michelle wanted to turn an atom into a machine. And this is when she made an important decision. she decided to move from Oxford to Sydney to make it happen.
And so I came to Australia because it was a land where basically people would take risks, would do things that were ambitious and work in a highly collaborative way.
Michelle left for Sydney on the cusp of a new millennium, and Australia was about to go through a transformation in scientific research. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Dead and Alive, a special series from Science Friction. I'm Jacinta Bowler.
I served on several RAM warships. I was a seaman officer and also a diver in the Royal Australian Navy.
In the 2000s, this was the man leading the charge in quantum technology in Australia. Professor Robert Clark, or Bob to his friends, grew up in rural Victoria. The Naval College offered him the chance to study science.
So I completed my honours year while I was still serving full-time at sea.
What does that look like? So you're on a ship, you're doing this research while you're going on to dives? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, look, this was the very early days of computers. So I was able to write computer programs in my spare time.
Mm. After you did a big day of work, you'd be going and doing some computer coding.
Correct, yeah.
Robert eventually traded the warships for the Clarendon Lab at Oxford University, doing experimental physics.
In particular, in rare earth compounds. And, of course, we were just looking at how the quantum world worked in these structures. But people were starting to ask a very different question, and that was, OK, so they have all of these unique new properties. How do we use these properties to build a machine?
When Robert returned to Australia, he became the director of one of the first ever centres of excellence. This one was in quantum technology. And he brought this question back with him. Can you harness quantum physics to build a machine? He didn't call this a quantum computer yet, though. So when did Robert start to think of this far-off machine as a computer?
So I have to tell you about a young man from the United States.
This man is Bruce Kane, and he'd come to the University of New South Wales in the late 90s.
It was evident right from the very start that he was a talent, and I tried to interest Bruce in immediately working on quantum effects in silicon nanostructures.
Bruce said, no thanks, not interested. But clearly the suggestion had an impact, because later...
Bruce came to me with three hardback notebooks and said, Bob, I have been working away on an idea, and I'd like you to look at this idea. I've set it out in these notebooks.
Bruce had set out a plan to build a quantum computer by embedding a single atom into silicon, a material already widely used in electronics. It is called Silicon Valley for a reason. Using silicon made this plan of building a quantum computer seem almost feasible.
I was the first person to see this, and I think possibly the only person to see it and talk to Bruce about it prior to its submission for publication, and it's now one of the most highly cited papers in physics.
At least in quantum computing. One of the people who saw that paper was Michelle Simmons. It's a big reason she came to Australia. She thought, hang on a minute, this could actually work.
Let's give you imagine if I wanted to make the best physical system, what would it look like? And I think this is about as close as you can get.
In Bruce Kane's paper, he doesn't just lay out a blueprint for a quantum machine. He also concludes, building the computer presented here will obviously be an extraordinary challenge. It takes a certain kind of person to read that and go, yeah, all right, I'll give it a crack. Michelle was that person.
As soon as I realised the technology had the potential to be commercial, I felt a tremendous responsibility to translate it. And I realised that I, just by nature, have a very infinite amount of energy. And so I realised I felt the responsibility and I had the energy to do it.
There were some major hurdles to overcome. For instance, how do you control a single atom? Michelle and her team started by trying to turn a single atom into a transistor, a switch that can represent either a one or a zero, the building blocks of classical computing.
The technology works at a minuscule level.
And in 2012, they did it.
Scientists at the University of New South Wales have been able to store a huge amount of information on a single atom in a silicon chip.
Then it was time to turn this atom into a qubit, to make things truly quantum. This means the atom can represent a one or a zero, or anything in between, all thanks to something called superposition. Superposition is the ability for an atom to be in multiple states at the same time. It can be really hard to get your head around, but the important thing to know is it's superposition that gives a quantum computer its ability to calculate so much at once.
So the way I describe superposition in my head, I have a visual picture, and it literally is very simple. You have a magnet, it's pointing at the North Pole, that's your one. Your magnet pointing at the South Pole, that's zero. If you get that magnet pointing to the equator, it's in essentially a combination of the up state and a combination of the down state. So that's superposition. So it's existing up and down at the same time.
But one qubit doesn't change the world of computing. Some say we need thousands. Others say we need upwards of a million. And these qubits need to be connected by something called entanglement, the most mysterious-seeming quantum property of all. This is where particles become intrinsically linked. How? We have no idea. But entanglement essentially holds quantum computers together.
I joke that the whole world is entangled, but if you just take two qubits and you bring them close enough together, you're creating a unique, unified state that operates in a different way from the individual states.
Superposition and entanglement give quantum computers their power. It's what enables them to compute more things faster than a regular computer. But these quantum properties also make machines like this vulnerable. Enter quantum computers' biggest foes: noise and decoherence.
It's a closed-loop system, so it does have a compressor, and the compressor, I'll try and do a sound of it, goes... K-sh-tum, k-sh-tum, k-sh-tum.
While I really did enjoy getting Australian of the Year Michelle Simmons to emulate the sound of her quantum computer,
k-sh-tum, k-sh-tum, k-sh-tum.
The issue with noise has nothing to do with the noise the computer makes. It's the noise of the environment, essentially the energy of our everyday that can disrupt a quantum computer. Heat, radio waves, cosmic rays, they can cause something called decoherence, which is where a qubit is knocked out of its position. It was a one, and now it's not anymore. So how are you supposed to do a calculation when the qubits fall over before the calculation is done? Well, get this. You have to build in a whole other ecosystem of qubits that are capable of righting wrongs in your quantum computer.
And so the error correction process, which quantum computers rely on, means that you have to have other qubits around to detect when it's happening and to bring them back online.
You've heard a few times in this series that we don't have a full-scale quantum computer. Our current quantum computers sit in a fuzzy middle ground, somewhere between useless and useful. That's the era of quantum computing we're in now, the noisy intermediate scale. To move beyond this, we need to find a way for tens of thousands of entangled qubits in a superposition of states to make fast, accurate calculations without collapsing into a jumbled, indecipherable mess. In Brisbane, there's a mission underway to do exactly that.
Yeah, my name's Jeff Pride. I'm the Chief Technical Director for PsiQuantum in Australia.
I'm here in Brisbane to visit the offices of PsiQuantum, a US company that aims to build a quantum computer with 1 million qubits within the next few years. And it wants to build it right here. Well, a 45-minute drive north of here, in the coastal region of Moreton Bay. It's not exactly where you'd expect the world's first million-qubit quantum computer.
It's one thing to build a machine that has tens or hundreds or thousands of qubits, but to go to of order a million qubits, the challenges become different.
Right now, the biggest quantum computers in the world are sitting at roughly 1,000 qubits. PsiQuantum hasn't even shown off a computer at this scale. They want to leapfrog this noisy era of quantum computing entirely.
Companies that are building smaller machines are hoping that even though we can't implement full error correction on that scale, that something useful can be done. But the trouble is that at the moment, we don't really think there are any useful applications that we can point to today and say, this is a lot better than what you could do on a conventional computer.
Not everyone agrees a million qubits is the way. Some argue the quality of the qubit matters much more than the quantity. Although Jeff would say that PsiQuantum is aiming for both.
Controlling the world at the quantum level is a tricky thing. And that's why it's natural that people ask about, well, how can we have, you know, 10 qubits and then 100 and then 1,000? Because controlling the quantum world is a big job.
I'm here to take a look at some of the hardware PsiQuantum has developed to get the job done. However, a warning. It is all a bit hush-hush.
Avoid any such thing.
What about it is special that needs to be protected?
Can we go off the record for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, they do not want the finer details of their chip exposed to the broader public. Other companies would love to know exactly what PsiQuantum is up to. But after some negotiating, Jeff agrees to at least describe the quantum chip that's going to be at the heart of their machine.
Yeah, so the first item here on the left, a silicon chip, 300 millimetres in diameter, consists of the photon sources and detectors and all the things in between that allow us to control our qubits. I describe it as like a CD because when we stand here and look at it, we can see rainbow-like reflections coming off it. And that's because there's all these millionth of a metre scale devices that are on there. And just like on a CD grooves, they kind of give you that diffraction pattern, that rainbow effect that you see. So it's quite a beautiful thing to look at.
They do let me hold it, which is pretty surprising. It's about the size of a large dinner plate, and it's not as heavy as I thought it would be. I'm still very worried about dropping it, though, because what I'm holding is not just one quantum chip, it's dozens.
So we chop it up into smaller pieces, and those pieces are themselves the chips.
PsiQuantum is one of the few companies explicitly aiming for 1 million qubits. They see it as their best approach to get away from the noisy era of computing and into the useful era, where quantum computers are solving real problems. Simulating protein folding or chemical catalysts, discovering drugs, finding farming solutions, modelling the weather.
We might not solve every problem known to humanity, but it can address probably a much, much wider scope than we think today.
The most complex multi-tool around.
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. That's why we're excited about it. That's why we do what we do. It's still going to be a complicated machine, but it's not one now that seems like some science fiction pie in the sky. It's something that we can stare down and we can say, you know what? We can do that. Let's do it really fast.
It's easy to get impatient about when quantum computing might arrive. And so, from a computer that doesn't work yet to a computer that doesn't work anymore, my tour guide from earlier, Peter Thorne, suggests that our capacity for patience has changed a lot since the early days of Australia's first digital computer, CyRac. After all, it used to take at least 30 minutes to turn on this massive computer.
These days, if your machine doesn't boot up within 30 seconds, you're pretty upset about it. But 30 minutes was probably pretty good in those days.
Across its life, CyRac solved hundreds of problems, all the way down under, before the internet made it possible to share knowledge at the drop of a hat. Australia was making its own strides in computing.
It's a symbol of innovation, which I think is so important that we are an innovative nation. And we are, but it's not recognised by the media and by the public as it ought to be. So, and we're not at the end of this. People in Australia are working on quantum computing, so who knows where that will go. It was hard to see where computing would go at the beginning. How can we sort of foresee the future?
Michelle Simmons doesn't think she can predict the future, but she can look at old computers like CyRac to get a sense of a potential timeline.
You know, when was the first transistor? 1947. When's the first integrated circuit? 1958. When's the first products? Around about 1964. And the first commercial computer? 1981. And so what's great is someone's actually gone through the various things that you have to do before. And what we're doing now is adapting that to a world that is at the edge of human knowledge and where it's much more fragile. So there are other things we have to take into account, but it gives us a guide.
But even Michelle Simmons doesn't have a crystal ball. For the fourth and final episode of Science Friction, Dead and Alive, we'll speak to someone who does. we're going to look at how these promises, for example, a million qubit machine just around the corner, builds hype in quantum computing.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
And whether that hype train is finally running out of steam. Science Friction, Dead and Alive is a special series for ABC Radio National. It was made on the lands of the Wurundjeri, Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Jacinta Bowler. Our senior producer is Shelby Traynor. Our sound engineer is Tim Jenkins. Thanks to producers Fiona Pepper and James Bullen for script editing. Next week, I'll be in two places at once, so I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.